Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, as January draws to a close, politics in 2017 gathers momentum. Donald Trump has been sworn in as the US president and seeks to balance a flurry of activity on immigration, trade and pipelines of various sorts with rows over alternative facts and rigged elections, whilst in the UK, Theresa May grapples with Brexit ahead of her meeting with President Trump this Friday. Now, the Supreme Court has told the Prime Minister she must get Parliament's approval for triggering Article 50, and the government has been forced into publishing a white paper on the subject. But with the public seemingly behind Brexit, more on that later, and the Tories very much ahead in the opinion polls, she does look at least in control of events for now. On today's show, we're going to be discussing some of these issues, along with the second Polling Matters opinion poll. But first, we're going to talk about last weekend's Women's March, a march that dominated the weekend's headlines as hundreds of thousands of women across the world took to the streets. But what was it for? What did it hope to achieve? And where do we go from here? I'm going to be discussing these issues and others today with Labour blogger and political activist Jade Frances Azim. Jade, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And CEO and tech entrepreneur Susie Dean of Ad365, one of a handful of women in leadership positions in the IT field in the UK. Susie, welcome.
Hello.
So, I mean, let's get cracking. There's lots to discuss. Jade, on the Women's March, I mean, you were there at the weekend, weren't you? I just wanted to get your thoughts on what prompted you to attend and what you think it was trying to achieve.
So largely two things, the first being solidarity with American women. So me and my friend Helena Horton at The Telegraph, we started UK Friends of Planned Parenthood, and we saw that there was obviously a threat to reproductive rights in the US alongside other rights. And I thought it was important to sort of show a sense of international feminism, international solidarity. But the second is the acknowledgement that with this tide of the populist right, with this sort of encroaching authoritarianism in a way, there's a sense that it may come to our shores. I mean, when you see the tide turning against the progressive left in other areas, such as, you know, immigration and social liberalism in general, there's no reason to not anticipate it might also happen to abortion rights and other rights of women.
Mm. And I must admit, it sort of caught me on the hop, the size of the march at the weekend. I'd heard that it was happening, and it was kind of one of those things that, oh, there's going to be this march. Never for once assumed it was going to be as big as it was or dominating the news agenda as it did. But what struck me as well was that there was quite a lot of opposition to it from some well-known celebrities, naming no names, Piers Morgan. Leaving the celebrities aside, but just more generally, why do you think there was such a strength of opposition to it, even in some aspects on the left?
So on the right, there's the idea that, you know, we've reached sort of the precipice and we have achieved women's equality. On the left, there was a legitimate talk about white women and how you needed to understand that feminism needed to be intersectional and that, you know, obviously white women voted for Trump. So there's that. I think with people like Piers Morgan, the sort of general sentiment that he put forward, what was it he said about the emasculation of his gender? I think there's...
Well, he said he was going to plan a man's march or a men's march to protest at creeping global emasculation of my gender by rabid feminists who's with me.
I think it's a general misunderstanding of what feminism seeks to achieve, but that's always been there. It's just more pronounced now.
Mm. Susie, what do you make of it? I mean, it certainly seemed to be a very popular march. As I mentioned, took me by surprise, actually, just the sheer numbers of people involved. And what was your take on it?
I think the biggest challenge I could see with it is that there wasn't a comprehensive viewpoint. So you talked about being there around reproductive rights. The march itself billed itself as being about inclusivity and positivity. Madonna was talking about burning down the White House. We had others there, because they were against slut shaming. There was a piece this week in The Guardian about how somebody went to make the point about climate change. Mayor Khan was there for women's rights, but he didn't say what or how. And an Iraqi march organiser said that women were daring to stand up to challenges including lack of salaries, terror, hate, exploitation and trafficking. And so I think the challenge with this, where I see the desire to go out and to protest is a really positive thing. I think the challenge with it is that there's a lack of coherence about what that march is for. And actually, if we break each of those down, and, you know, Jay's got a very good point that there is this sort of... you know, anti-immigration, slightly authoritarian energy creeping into politics. I think if we're serious about cracking that, we've got to be really clear about each one of those issues and put a very substantial case and point of view across on all of them. And to some extent, if I'm going to be really controversial, I'd say we slightly degrade democracy when we have 2 million women come together. We go, oh, that in and of itself is a success. It's almost like a bit of a pat on the back for turning up with a placard. Whereas actually, I would challenge anyone that was at that march in any country to really substantiate and to bottom out what it is they were trying to push for.
Isn't part of it first and foremost to make a point? You've got Donald Trump elected as president, talking about grabbing women by the pussy, and you know, the usual threats to women's rights that the Republican Party may be demonstrating in the US that is arguably less the case with the Conservative Party here. I mean, isn't it really about just first and foremost making a point that you're angry about this and you want to stand up against it?
But angry about what? You know, you're quite right. A lot of the women marching in the US, it was a very anti-Trump statement and it was a response to his comments. This is not what people in Iraq or necessarily in London were marching for. So I think it's very dangerous to say, you know, those 2 million women represented one thing. I think the other thing as well is, you know, you talked about, Jade, you know, to some extent, women having reached a level of equality. And this for me is one of the... you know, I can't get on board with that, because actually I think there is one area in which women are really falling behind, and that's when it comes to their role in the workplace. And what I mean by that is that they're continuously outperforming men in schools, in universities, and then they get into the workplace and they fall behind in terms of where they get to in the career ladder. And that is squarely down to childcare provision in this country, where unless you're earning more than 60k a year, it actually doesn't make financial sense to continue working. So you've got loads of really competent women working their way up that career ladder. They get to about 30, which is when, you know, the really competent go on to directorships. And guess what? That's also the time that women feel that they should be starting a family. And so for me, actually, there is inequality. There are issues in the UK and around the world with the you know, disproportionately impact women. But actually, part of the challenge about, you know, just saying there are women marching for recognition and, you know, the vague Piers Morgan statements about, you know, men's marches versus women's marches, is we're unable to really get our teeth into the real problems that are impacting women's standard of living.
I want to bring Jade back in a moment, but I mean, is a march ever really going to be about one policy objective? I mean, surely like a march of that size is always going to have a certain degree of catch-all to it.
That's because it appealed to a catch-all. You know, I think there's a lack of...
But to be that big.
But there's a lack of coherent opposition to a lot of the ideas we're seeing from our government and the government in the US. And that's part of the problem with it. You know, particularly when... I know we'll come on to it. When you look at the Trump and Hillary options, you think, my God, they're two pretty horrific options. Where's the opposition to that? Well, we know that it exists within the public because of the level of dissatisfaction, but it's not been crystallised anywhere.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Jade, one of the criticisms that people throw at these sorts of marches is that they're quite exclusive. I think you touched on it in your opening remarks. And I guess what I want to talk about is how Trump managed to win white women, not women overall. It does, that would suggest that maybe sometimes these marches can be a sort of liberal, well-educated, sort of not niche, but kind of appealing to a certain type of woman, whereas clearly there's other women out there that maybe have stayed at home and supported Trump. I mean, what do you make of that?
I just want to touch on a few points. Like, first of all, the march didn't have a single objective. On the day, I felt being there, it was about just sort of that sense of empowerment, that sense of opposition. What that opposition becomes or what it will be, it depends on what we make of the legacy. So, I mean, one of the things we're talking about, or people have been talking about, is a Tea Party of the left. I mean, the Tea Party basically was sort of a prerequisite to Trumpism in a lot of ways. Perhaps what comes out of this is an intersectional feminism that's also sort of touches upon specific issues. I think on the point of exclusivity, we need to face up to the fact that I think 52% of white women voted for Trump. Why this is largely because, especially in America, race is a larger determinant of voting than gender is. It's a far larger in terms of a mobilisation force. Part of the reason that is because of various interests in terms of history of women. So white women earn more than Latina women, for instance. That there are those various factors, and the way that we make sure that that doesn't form into an exclusive movement in the future of left white liberal women is to make sure the people leading it are women of colour. As we saw, that march in America was led by free women of colour. And we need to make sure that that also happens in the UK, that we have an intersectional and also working class feminist movement in the future.
But you're being very reductionist. You're effectively saying that people vote a certain way based on their race or gender, and you're talking about the fact we need more women of colour to lead as though they represent a homogenous group in society. No. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you are robbing people of their sense of personhood when you take that point of view. I'm a woman, but I've got very different views to you, and you're a woman. So the fact that any one of us could stand up and purport to represent women is obviously not correct. Equally, you do a disservice to say that women of colour will have a certain point of view when one compared to another, much like us, could have dramatically different standpoints. I mean, for someone on the left, I would expect you to be a lot more pro-solidarity, and that means much more cohering around the ideas of, a democracy and more equality, rather than saying, you're black, you go in that box, you're white, you go in that box, you're a white woman, you go in that box. I mean, I'm frankly sick of hearing about the categorisation of people as though there is no sense of individuality and of personhood.
No, I don't agree in terms of the homogenisation of any one woman or group, but it's a matter of fact that I think it's 92% of black women in the United States voted for Hillary Clinton and 52% of white women voted for Donald Trump. I'm just stating the fact of voting and how race was a far greater determinator of vote than gender was in America. I mean, that's a fact.
Then what do you think the role of Hillary Clinton was? I mean, we'll come on to the Britain in a minute, but one of the things that Hillary Clinton was very sort of proud and vocal about saying was that she was going to shatter that glass ceiling. But clearly, a large number of women didn't particularly care for that. And there must have been there's interesting, we talked about race, but there's an interesting dynamic between white women and Hillary Clinton, isn't there, as well?
Yeah, I think Hillary Clinton was generally an uninspiring candidate, as we touched upon. But also, I think there's that sense Trumpism appealed to something in the group that voted for him, whether they be men or women. He appealed to a sort of nativist sentiment that Hillary Clinton couldn't replicate. Certainly she couldn't replicate that sort of sentiment. She appealed to that what stronger together thing. It was very, and this is sort of also what I'll talk about in Brexit. The right have a very good way of expressing a really powerful message in a way that the left just doesn't do anymore, and her campaign sort of encapsulated that. There was no appeal to a popular sentiment.
For me, that's not what was going on there. I mean, Hillary, to me, represented the status quo. She followed in the steps of Barack Obama, Clinton, Bill before that, in the sense of, she stood up, she was on the side of the bankers, everything was business as usual. Yet in the US, much as in Western Europe, the rich are getting richer, the inequality between richest and poorest is increasing. And I think a lot of people just looked at that and went, you know what, let's give this guy a go. Right, he's not great, but it's a change, it's a step change, it's a difference, it's not the status quo.
Isn't there a reality, though, that Donald Trump's victory was largely an accident? I mean, when I say, so the comparison that's always made is with Brexit, and for obvious reasons, I completely understand them. It's to do with the so-called, I hate the phrase, but left behind in these post-industrial places, immigration's a key factor, anti-elitism, yeah. Get all of that, there's certainly parallels. But in Brexit, we had a 7 percentage point increase in turnout on the general election. And we had I think it was 52-48 victory for Leave, but it was over a million votes. Donald Trump lost the popular vote and actually won by a razor-thin margin in a number of Midwestern states. Yes, because of Hillary Clinton's unpopularity, but also because of lots of people were voting for Jill Stein and, Gary Johnson. And it was almost an accident of maths. as much as anything in what delivered him the presidency. Now his presidency is legitimate. He won fair and square under the rules.
Kieran,
but is this really a mass sort of endorsement of his politics?
Kieran, we wouldn't be having this conversation if the vote had gone to Hillary. We wouldn't be saying, oh, maybe the electoral system is at fault. What it is that complete shock in the establishment, much as we saw in the UK with the way the Brexit vote went, that people couldn't believe when all of the media and politicians and celebrities were so pro-Hillary, or as in the UK, so pro-Remain, that the majority of people could vote the other way. I mean, look, if people want to challenge the electoral model in the UK, or in the US, or they suddenly want to talk about the pros and cons of referendum, that's fine. But for me, it smacks of not getting your own way and then having a good old complain about it and trying to argue the toss on whether or not
I'm not arguing it's illegitimate. I'm just saying that when you're trying to assess what's going on and what the vote means, then you can't ignore the fact that he lost the popular vote. There was an element of fluke in the way that he won those states, in the way that there wasn't for Brexit, is my argument. With Brexit, it was 72% turnout, 52-48 victory, very clear rejection of the status quo. Like, the American stuff was slightly different, but hold that thought. I want to talk a bit about the UK, but feel free to come back on that if you want to. So, obviously, there was a march, big march in London, right? And as we've talked about, I think we've alluded to, very different situation in the US and UK, very different countries. I mean, how big a problem do we see? I mean, this is a bit of a naff question, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway as a starting point. How big a problem do we think sort of sexism and how big a challenge do women face for true equality in the UK? There was a recent report out by the Fawcett Society, which we'll talk about a little bit, polling done by Servation, which threw out some interesting findings. I'll just rattle through a couple of them. So 56% of men said that more needs to be done for men and women to be equal. 32% said they were equal now. And 13% said, whatever this means, it's gone too far. What I thought was really interesting was that older men were more likely than younger men to think that more needed to be done, which is actually, in my opinion, sort of counterintuitive to what you would normally think, where the older age groups are usually that bit more small-c conservative. On the flip side, women, 68% of women said more needs to be done, 20% said equal now, 11% said gone too far. So perhaps, unsurprisingly, women more likely to think that more needs to be done than men, but a good chunk of men saying that more needs to be done too. I mean, Jade, what's your general perception of women's position? Big question, I appreciate, but women's position in society in Britain, and kind of what are the key priorities for women to take on?
I mean,
Susie's mentioned some of them.
As a young worker that's just came out of university, one of the major experiences, and I'm sure Susie will go on to talk about the workplace, but for me, the most urgent memory I have is being on campus and seeing these sort of statistics manifest. Young men generally had, so the Feminist Society was always the most controversial on campus. I didn't know any women that weren't in some way sexually harassed or assaulted on a night out. These statistics are not at all surprising to me. It makes me, again, not surprising that also women have that perception. It's not just a man's perception. But I think both in terms of the workplace and in terms of how we simply exist in the public sphere, and that obviously goes into our politics as well. I mean, there was that thing where one in three female MPs had faced some sort of threat, or they'd felt threatened. I think we need to certainly look at how the public sphere treats women, especially on campuses. And I think the most terrifying statistic is the fact that there's a sort of regression in terms of age. I think that there is a sort of resurgence in terms of this sort of young male radicalism in a way. We've seen it sort of on, you know, 4chan and Reddit and things like that. Maybe that is starting to manifest.
Hmm. I mean, what do you make of it, Susie? I mean, one of the stats I think you'll probably, given what you said earlier, sort of find interesting was that 50% of men think that when a woman has a child, she becomes less committed to her job, whereas 15% of men say the same thing about men.
I mean, I believe in equality of men and women in the proper sense, and by that I mean men and women have the right to vote, and they both have equal choice when it comes to what they do with their lives, and I think as society, we have to do everything we can to make that possible. For me, the killer thing I mentioned earlier is the fact that, well, being blunt, I think we should have free childcare in the UK so that women that want to work and progress with their career can do, and those that don't have to. I think I absolutely would not define myself as a modern day feminist according to the contemporary standards, because I feel that a lot of the time when we read about feminism in the press, particularly from The Guardian and the Labour Party and the BBC, it's about women as being really weak and vulnerable. And Jade says that almost everyone she knows has been sexually harassed or assaulted on a night out. And I just think that's nonsense. Men might come up and try on with you because, you know, you're in a nightclub and that's what young people do, right? They try and get off with each other. There's all this stuff about slut-shaming and why can't I walk around naked without people staring? And I think it's got to this point where the common sense has just been taken out of things. And rather than appreciating the context in which we live in society, there's this kind of, screw you, I should be able to do whatever I want because I'm a woman. And if you look at me or talk to me in a way that I don't like, then you're at fault and you're a sexist and you're all these kind of terrible things. And I can't get on board with that, right? I think we need to level the playing field, as I said, when it comes to things like childcare and make sure people can do what they want. But I'm not a victim, right? I'm not a victim. And no one I know is a victim either, that's a woman.
I wouldn't say I'm a victim. I say these are legitimate things. I'm very empowered and I walk down the street quite happily. But these are very legitimate things. I have very legitimate case studies of women who were, you know, followed into a cubicle or herded around or forcibly kissed and we've had to remove them.
Oh, come on, Jade. Are you telling me a bloke's never lived to give you a snog in a nightclub after one?
No, but then he herds you into a corner. Yes, of course it is. If it's against your will, that is harassment.
I think you're broadening sexual harassment. You're undermining people that have experienced real sexual harassment.
No, the definition of harassment is for it to be non-consensual. I haven't consented to that. That's the definition. It's a definitive thing. I want to be able to walk around in a nightclub and make that choice for myself. That is empowerment.
I don't think so. I think, in a strong civil society, people can handle themselves and each other. And I think this interventionist sort of sense of
domination.
Don't touch me, don't look at me.
I just want to walk around the street without feeling like I'm...
Then walk around on an empty street, right? Society is messy. Society is messy, which means every day we have interactions... Every day we have interactions with men, with women, with children, with animals. That we might think, oh, God, you know, for goodness sake. We've all been stuffed up against someone's armpit on the tube, right? Is that harassment?
Isn't it patronising to say that men can't control themselves and can't... Wait for that signal that it's consensual.
Of course, men can control themselves.
Yeah, well, then I suppose you're the trying not to fear it.
You are trying to take a normal human interaction. Guy goes to kiss a girl.
No,
kind
that's
of thing.
Not normal.
And you're rewriting that as being a massive problem, demonstrative of how perverted and disrespectful men are to women.
I shouldn't be forward into a cubicle. It's just not normal human behaviour.
I think there's a broader challenge, as I see it, with a lot of these issues as being seen as women issues and feminist issues. And that's that actually we take away from the fact that they impact men and women alike. So lots of the stuff around Trump and abortion this week, around contraception, and actually even around childcare, these are all very human issues. And I think that as a society, we need a dialogue on what we think is right and what we think is wrong. And I don't like the idea that we would be cutting men out of those discussions or saying that their voice doesn't count. And actually, I think there's quite a lot of that going on at the moment where it's almost like you're a woman, therefore you can speak on behalf of women's issues. But any men that have an opinion on it are not wanted now as a daughter, as a partner, as a mother, as a friend. I think that, you know, to say that something like abortion and contraception impacts only women and therefore the man's opinion in it is useless takes away from the fact that there are men involved in these situations too.
I want to move on to the second part of the show about sort of Brexit and Theresa May, but I want to give Jade the opportunity to respond to that first before we do.
I simply think it's about your body, your choice. I don't think there's any greater example of empowerment than to make those decisions for yourself. And it is my body. I can do what I want. I can decide for myself if I want to have a baby. I can decide for myself if I want access to contraception and I want access to my reproductive rights, and that is empowerment for me.
Okay, let's move on. So this week was, as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, a big week in the Brexit debate. The Supreme Court in the UK probably had its most prominent moment, or at least since it's been devised, where it ruled that Theresa May has to get parliamentary approval to invoke Article 50. I mean, Jay, what's your perspective on the impact that this has on Brexit and on our direction of travel here? Because I suppose on the one hand, if the Supreme Court had backed the government, then, you know, Theresa May is all powerful, she can choose what happens next. But at the same time, is it really putting Brexit at risk, do you think?
No. I think there's very few Owen Smiths in the world, for instance. I generally do think that it's...
How terrible.
It's going to go through. It's just now there is an extra bit of scrutiny. Did Brexiters not just fight for parliamentary sovereignty? This literally just adds a dimension of scrutiny that we should have as part of our parliamentary procedure.
Susie or Jane?
Democracy means sovereignty of the people, and because people every day can't get involved in the technocratic decision making that's required to run a country, we nominate representatives who are MPs. But actually, the role of Parliament is to put the will of the people into practice. On this occasion, it was decided by the government that we were going to go with direct democracy in order to make a decision on Brexit. And I think for me, that's that, right? The people have spoken, the people are sovereign, and therefore that has to be executed upon. You can't undo it. And I feel like the whole dialogue now seems to be around, can we demonstrate one way or another that they got the answer wrong? And I was really pleased with the poll stats that you shared with us.
No spoilers yet. We're going to reveal that in a moment.
Okay, well, I'll hold that thought then.
So some people on the right have referred to these judges as enemies of the people,
gosh,
and said that they, they're kind of actively restricting the will of the people. That seems to be the direction of travel you're taking.
Well, I think they are. Gina
Miller, wasn't the legal point correct?
I don't care. I think ultimately...
That's what judges are for, right?
Well, hang on a minute. The referendum, it clearly said on the top of that slip, the government will implement what you decide. I don't care who challenges that. I don't care that Gina Miller or a bunch of lawyers or judges or the media or other politicians want to challenge that. You know, the people have spoken and that has to be implemented. Now, look, it's the largest political mandate in British political history, right? More than a million people voted in favour to leave. On a 72% turnout. I mean, damn cheek that some rich woman and a couple of judges can stand in the way of that.
What do you think, Jade?
We didn't vote for any particular kind of Brexit. When you survey people on, you know, the definition of soft and hard, how we define it, it's largely split. I mean, there's been sort of a waving between maybe a move towards hard Brexit. But in terms of what that means in terms of the single market, we have like seven different options. We don't know. That wasn't on the ballot paper. It was a simple yes or no dichotomous question. We don't know. It's more than just a will of the people. We don't know what the will of people was. Yes, to leave the EU, but on what terms?
Simply. So we leave the EU.
On what terms?
And then Theresa May is negotiating what those terms look like. I feel like the reason that the Labour Party is in such a dire position is because actually they are pretty much the cheerleaders of the position that the majority that voted to leave are racist, are ignorant of what they voted for, and are a bunch of oiks. And I've seen more sneery snobbiness coming out of The Guardian and the BBC and the Labour Party than I ever imagined was possible. And I think, actually, this is why, should there be a general election tomorrow, Labour wouldn't have a hope in hell of winning. They really have a terrible attitude towards British people.
Well, we'll come to the Labour Party in a moment because their situation is particularly complicated vis-a-vis the leadership and the PLP and membership and all the rest of it. But I do want to look at the poll findings from the second Polling Matters opinion poll, which we'll be tweeting out this evening. This is Wednesday. And we asked a very simple question, which was whether or not people thought Britain had made the sort of UK had made the right or wrong decision in voting to leave the European Union. And what we did differently on this poll, which is I've not seen on other polls, maybe it does exist, is we tried to introduce a little bit of nuance into the findings by saying, was it definitely the right decision? Was it probably the right decision? Was it probably the wrong decision? Or was it definitely the wrong decision? And people often also had the option of saying, don't know as well, which they should in these sorts of polls. And the headline figures were that 52% said that this was the right decision, 39% said it was the wrong decision. And speaking of that nuance, which I thought was important, 40% said it was definitely right, and 23% said it was definitely wrong. And I think that this shows quite clearly, whichever side of the debate you're on, the passion, as we probably already knew, is on the Leave side. If we look specifically at people that voted Remain and Leave, we find that 93% of Leave voters think it was the right decision to leave, whereas only 77% of Remain voters think it was the wrong decision to leave. So again, maybe some Remainers being a bit flakier on the subject, maybe they didn't care as much in the first place, or maybe they're giving the mandate of the British people time to wait and see what happens. We really don't know from this question. We can only sort of guess, whereas what we don't need to guess is that 93% of Leave voters saying it's the right decision. There isn't a lot of regrexit or whatever term you want to use there. And beyond that, there are some party splits that are interesting. 33% of Labour voters say that they think it's the right decision. One in four Conservative voters think it's the wrong decision. So it'll be interesting to see if any sort of genuine political realignment happens over Brexit. It seems at the moment that old habits die hard in terms of voting intention. But on some of those numbers, Jade, it does seem, not just from this poll really, from lots of polls, that the Leave side is much more committed to their vote than the Remain side is to theirs.
Yeah, and also on in terms of Remainers and Labour in general, there is a lack of coherence. There's not much of a message in terms of what Remain is, in terms of what Brexit will mean. I mean, we don't know about the single market, anything like that. I think the lack of commitment in terms of the Remainers is that we don't actually know what the objective is. We don't know what the opposition would look like in terms of stopping exiting the single market. We don't know what messages we'd put out there to ensure that our side are committed to that. What's interesting, I think, is that, especially from a younger point of view, that the fact that the margin is so small, so 44-47 in favour of it being a wrong decision, I think that shows...
That's among the 18 to 34s,
yeah. Yeah, 18 yeah. to 34s. That shows the lack of... I mean, you saw on the doorstep, there was a lack of commitment in terms of people that were most impacted and people that should have voted so much against it in terms of, you know, general weighting. So I think that itself, on a microcosm, shows our problem. We don't infuse people.
I was really pleased by it. What it showed to me was that despite Gina Miller's attempts to thwart and murder democracy in front of our eyes, despite, you know, all this navel-gazing nonsense about is it soft Brexit, is it hard Brexit, that actually fundamentally people still want to leave the EU and to take that democratic control back from a highly undemocratic institution. So to me, the breakdown of age groups and all this kind of thing is less interesting than the all-up numbers, which are, despite the establishment's continued attempts to put doubt in people's minds as to the right, you know, should Brexit happen or not, people are standing firm.
As a Democrat, I mean, Jade, I assume you would call yourself a Democrat, given what you've said.
Yeah.
I mean, Jade mentioned earlier that... you know, we don't know what Brexit's going to look like here. And your response was, well, Theresa May has got the mandate to negotiate that, right?
Yeah.
So what do you say to these people that say, well, OK, that's fine, but when she does and she comes back to the British people with a deal, there should be a second referendum on those terms, because maybe when they see what it is in reality, people will change their minds. What do you make of that?
I think the British people have voted out, so that's the first step. We have to leave. There's then a renegotiation period, and then that becomes a dialogue. If there are aspects of that we think we could have had better, then they will continue to be debated and fought for. What I think is absolutely unacceptable is to allow the UK to fall into an analysis paralysis, where until we understand every last condition of every last possible outcome to do with every last bit of legislation, we're not going to do anything, because to that end, we'd end up staying in the EU. So my view is we get out and then we work it through. Life is long.
What do we make of Scotland? Because one of the crossbreaks, which won't be a surprise to people, shows that Scottish people think it was the wrong decision. 51% say wrong, 40% say right, which is actually higher than I'd expect. I should put a massive health warning on that. I don't have a sample size in front of me, but it was around 150, and you shouldn't really extrapolate too much from the specific figures on something like that. But I think we can safely say, from what we know, given that Scotland voted Remain overwhelmingly, that Scots tend to think Brexit was a wrong decision. I mean, are we about to witness the breakup of the UK, Jay, do you think?
I mean, what was interesting in that Supreme Court case was that the devolved parliaments, it was decided they wouldn't have the option to vote against it. What has surprised me in the aftermath is how little there's been in terms of an increase in support for Scottish independence. I was one of the people that thought that this would lead to the breakup of the UK, but actually now I'm a bit sceptical of that.
The polls don't seem... They moved a bit at first and then they kind of settled back down to where they were.
I think Nicola Sturgeon is probably facepalming right now.
Mm. Let's finish last couple of minutes on Theresa May. We talked a little bit about her during this discussion, both in terms of feminism but also in terms of Brexit. I mean, she seems very, very strong in the opinion polls, Susie, doesn't she? I mean, why? It does seem to be more now than a honeymoon period. That's what people put it down to at first, that, well, she's a new prime minister. They get a bit of a bump when this happens, but it seems to me to have lasted. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Theresa May has come under a huge amount of pressure since the Brexit vote, and my gut told me that she would, you know, stand strong for a couple of weeks, and then, you know, she would give in to the pressure and she would start watering things down and trying to delay them. And I'm really pleased to see that she's supporting and standing up for the democratic will of the people. That's very pleasing. Can she sustain it? I don't know. And actually, I think if you take the Brexit issue away, what does she really stand for? It's very hard to tell. I, for one, the only other policy that comes to mind that she's really spearheaded is the Investigatory Powers Act, i.e. the Snoopers Charter, which I'm dead against. So I do wonder if...
Grammar schools as well, I think. Or some form of them.
Yes, but precisely. I mean, you almost want to say, yes, great job on Brexit, but take that away, what do you stand for?
Mm. And what do you think, Jada? I guess that you can't really look at Theresa May's ratings without looking at the leader she's compared against.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, as I was saying before, is the simplicity of her argument. Like, the left is often attacking her in the same way that they attacked George Osborne's fixing the roof while the sun shines, etc. and so forth. The right are just generally better at understanding the simplicity of powerful messages and understanding when people say Brexit means Brexit, that actually strikes a chord. Mm. I mean, that annoys the hell out of me, but it's obviously struck a chord. The second thing, of course, is that Jeremy Corbyn is just a very weak leader.
Mm. I mean, working people have got it really hard at the moment. Most people are priced out of buying a home. There are loads of zero-hours contracts. Infrastructure in this country is abysmal. These are all traditionally issues of the left and things that really do impact the working classes. Yet the Labour Party have been completely unable to cohere or to come up with anything remotely appealing to society, which I think really shows a huge disconnect. And I wonder if we'll have a Labour Party in 5 years' time.
Isn't the elephant in the room, which you miss out of that analysis, immigration? I mean, if you look at the crossbreaks, as I do in polls, on the most important issue facing the country or reasons for voting Brexit, immigration is usually at the top of the list or very much up there. And the crude measure of class being the sort of C2D voter is overwhelmingly in favour of more controls on immigration. That's not something the left usually gets behind for various obvious reasons. I mean, isn't there a reality that the working classes don't necessarily conform to this coherent left wing?
Do you know what? Everyone is against immigration. The Labour Party, the Conservative Party, there are lots of people around Brexit that said, the Leave campaign wasn't about immigration at all, and I think that's nonsense, because when I talk to people around where I was brought up, immigration was one of the big topics for them, and I think it's one of the real issues that everybody engaged in politics has sort of gone, oh, shut up, we don't want to talk about that, yet actually it's something that really impacts most working people in terms of where they understand the problems in society to come from. And actually, in a way, the establishment holds a mirror up to that and says, yeah, we agree. We also think there should be a cap on immigration. I have to say, I'm for open borders, right? And there is not a single person I can look at in the establishment or anywhere that defends that point of view. I think that's a real shame.
Let's finish with a sort of brief word on Theresa May and feminism, because we started off by talking about the Women's March and feminism and that sort of thing. How important do you guys think it is to women, if you like, to use that crude term, to women that she is a woman, that Theresa May is a female prime minister? I mean, how significant do you think that is in the debate we've been having today? I mean, Jade, what do you think?
I don't know. It's very strange, isn't it? I think, first of all, the fact that the Labour Party's never had a female leader, and that I think it was 7 parties now in the UK have had a female leader, shows that I think the left hasn't sort of capitalised on that in a way that the right has. The right sort of tried to normalise it and make it a non-issue. I do think it's an issue, and I think female representation is real important. But I think that the right has sort of put forward women as if to say it's not about me being a woman, and they've tried to play down the sort of identity politics. I would like to see one day I'd like to see Theresa May go to this meeting with Trump as a woman and say, hang on, you need to think about the things that you've said, you need to think about these issues. I'd really like to advocate for Planned Parenthood. So I'd like Theresa May to bring it up, and because she said she's a feminist, I'd like to see her act as a feminist.
Mm. I have a real problem with the idea that Theresa May should act as a woman. I don't think she represents womankind. I don't think womankind has a pre-written set of needs and desires. I think women, and certainly I, am judging Theresa May based on her politics and her actions as a prime minister, as I would a man or a dog for that matter. You know, I really think we need to get beyond defining our affinities based on biology, whether it's trans, black, woman or any other description that the left seem to be obsessed with.
But then that would suggest that a parliament, for example, in the UK, I mean, we are running out of time, but a parliament in the UK that's 100% men is fine, as long as their politics is right. Do you agree with that?
I want my MP to represent my views. I don't care what race or sex they are. And that, I believe, is absolutely correct. I think the reason that we don't have more women in prominent positions in business or politics goes back to this childcare issue, which I keep banging the drum on, which is very competent women end up leaving the workforce because they simply can't afford childcare. And so to me, that and implementing that would really change a lot of the demographics we see.
Final word to Jade.
Representation isn't the be-all and end-all, but as you see with working-class MPs, it's been shown that the decline in the Labour vote has also come with the decline in working-class candidates. That in itself is an identity. Class is an identity alongside every other kind of identity. It matters that there are women there, it matters that there are people of colour, that it matters that they're disabled, etc. and so forth, because people feel inspired and people see themselves in their representatives and they want to go into politics. And I think also that when you have those perspectives, you'll start to see as a normalisation, and you'll start to see that these attacks on female MPs are talked about more regularly, they don't suffer in silence, and that we actually come to a head in terms of these issues and we make sure that people are empowered to talk about these issues.
Final comment, Susan.
How would you feel if you were put in Parliament just because you have a vagina and nobody cared what Jade thought? Because that's what you're saying.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
It is, because you're saying that a black person being in Parliament is inspiring and that's good enough because they're black, and a woman being there is inspiring, that's good enough because she's a woman. I think that, you know, you've got real low self-esteem and sense of what people are about if you think that they should be privileged and put in positions based on their biology. I think that's a really sad state of affairs.
Actually, last word to Jade now, because we are running out of time.
No, I am empowered as a strong person, as well as being a strong woman, etc. and so forth. But I think that when you see an all-male, for instance, when I go to a conference, I'm going to see an all-male panel, I don't feel empowered. Like, I feel as a strong woman, I want someone there that looks like me, not because they're a woman, but because it means that there are more people inspired to get involved. It's not just on the basis of identity. I think that a diverse parliament that looks like the community they represent is more legitimate, and it is more inspiring.
Well, that's unfortunately all we've got time for, but a great debate, great discussion today. Big thanks to my guests, Jade and Susie. That's all we've got time for this week's episode. If you like what you hear, do subscribe on iTunes, like the Facebook page, share us on social media, check us out and comment on politicalbetting.com and all the rest of it. It does help get our voice out there. But for now, that's all we've got time for. Stay tuned for the full data tables and analysis of our second Polling Matters opinion poll, and more to come in the next week or so. Next week we'll be talking about Northern Ireland, perhaps the forgotten story of the entire Brexit debate, what will happen in the province as we leave the EU. Stay tuned for more on that next week, and thanks for listening.